The C. Henry Smith Peace Oratorical Contest was established in 1974 by the directors of the C. Henry Smith Trust, and it's now administered by the Peace and Justice Ministries of Mennonite Central Committee, U.S. Undergraduate students from every Mennonite and Brethren in Christ College in North America are eligible to participate. C. Henry Smith was an American Mennonite historian and professor at Bluffton University and Goshen College. He taught history for over 50 years at the collegiate level, and he's well known for many books, including his particular interest in the peace commitments of Mennonites. EMU has participated in this event ever since 2003, and EMU students have won the bi-national competition in 2003, 2004, 2007, 2009, 2011, but we're not putting any pressure on this year's group. I got that line from Gloria Rhodes, by the way. We want to especially express our gratitude this evening to the three persons who are judging our contest. They are Dr. Catherine Barnes. She joined CJP in fall 2011, and she serves as Associate Professor for Strategic Peacebuilding and Public Policy. She specializes in war peace transitions and civil society roles in peace building, and she's worked in that area for the past 20 years. She holds a doctorate in conflict analysis from George Mason University. Catherine, maybe raise your hand. The judges are in the middle here, so. Our second judge is Phil Niss. Phil is the lead pastor at Parkview Mennonite Church since 1996, and he had earlier served at Emmanuel Mennonite in Florida and Community Mennonite Church here in Harrisonburg. He has a Master of Divinity from Eastern Mennonite Seminary and a Doctorate of Ministry from Northern Baptist Theological Seminary. Phil also sings in the men's a cappella group Cantore, and he's giving up practice tonight to be with us, so thank you, Phil. And James Richardson, who is a baritone. Many of you have heard him perform. He's assistant professor of music at EMU with a master's from Peabody Conservatory of Music. James has given many vocal recitals and performances, and those of you who were here in February may have heard his rendition of the Jabberwocky in a recital that he gave here at EMU. James also has extensive experience in adjudicating a speech contest, and James will be the convener for the judges. So let's give our thanks to the judges. The contest this evening is sponsored by the Bible and Religion Department, the Language and Literature Department, and the Peacebuilding and Development Program of Applied Social Sciences. Thanks to Vi Dutcher, Gloria Rhodes, Joan Chamberlain for helping to plan the event. We will begin with number one, Sarah Schoenhals. Number two is Joel Nofziger. Number three is Taylor Weidman. Number four is Jamila Whitmer. Number five is Rose Beiler. Number six is Thomas Millery. And number seven is Julia Schmidt. So once again, we say welcome to all of you, and we will begin our presentations immediately with our first contestant, Sarah Schoenhals. Her presentation is titled Justice from Generation to Generation.
One in five. According to Michael McKenzie, this is the number of Americans who will be over the age of 65 by the year 2030. Compared to the early 1900s, when only one in 100 people were over the age of 65, this is a striking change. A drastic increase like this should prompt us, as followers of Christ, to examine the needs of this growing population and investigate how our faith addresses care for the elderly. We must discover ways to bring peace, justice, and wholeness as individuals and as churches to the older generations in our midst. To begin with, let's take a look at the three main barriers categorized by Kathleen Cavaney that prevent the elderly from experiencing full integration and wholeness into society. These are physical, social, and vocational. I acknowledge that these struggles are also faced by some individuals who are not elderly, but this speech will focus on how we can best create peace and wholeness with those over the age of 65. First, there is the issue of physical challenges. As adults age and become elderly, they begin to lose certain abilities and experience some degree of physical deterioration that limits their ability to perform activities of daily living, such as cooking, cleaning, or driving. This is a biological fact of life that is hard to avoid. Yet, even though the health problems that cause these challenges can rarely be avoided, many elderly persons can continue to live independently if they have some degree of outside support. The second challenge is a social barrier to integration within the community that is a result of a limited ability to participate in basic public activities, such as grocery shopping, the loss of important relationships due to death, such as the death of a spouse or a sibling, and from living alone. This causes social isolation and loneliness, which can contribute to depression in older adults. As shown by a community health survey from the local community, 41% of those 65 and older live alone. 17% of the local elderly population has been diagnosed with a form of depression or an anxiety disorder, and almost a quarter report enjoying life only 2 days a week or less. The third issue facing the elderly is one of vocational purpose. In order to be fully included in a community, each person must have a role through which they can contribute to the well-being of the whole. Many elderly have retired from their careers or no longer have households full of children to care for. Some are prevented from finding their niche in the community due to discrimination based on age or a disbelief that the elderly have something to contribute. These challenges create a search for purpose. With these three categories of physical, social, and vocational barriers in mind, let's take a look at what Scripture and Christian tradition have to say about care for the elderly. 1 Timothy 5 is a text which provides specific instructions for treating the elderly with justice. Never speak harshly to an older man, but appeal to him respectfully as you would your own father. Treat older women as you would your mother. Take care of any widow who has no one else to care for her. But if she has children or grandchildren, their first responsibility is to show godliness at home and repay their parents by taking care of them. This is something that pleases God. But those who won't care for their relatives, especially those in their own household, have denied the true faith. In this letter to Timothy, Paul calls upon children and grandchildren to care for their parents and grandparents as a way of showing godliness and as an act of reciprocity and gratitude for the care received from their parents and grandparents. Paul says that such care is pleasing to God, and he even goes so far as to say that those who do not care for their own family members are being untrue to their faith. Another biblical text that sheds some light on care for the elderly is the dialogue among Jesus and the Pharisees found in Mark 7. Then Jesus said, "You skillfully sidestep God's law in order to hold on to your own tradition. For instance, Moses gave you this law from God, 'Honor your father and mother.' But you say it is all right for people to say to their parents, 'Sorry, I can't help you, for I have vowed to give to God what I would have given to you.' And in this way, you let them disregard their needy parents." Though the primary purpose of Jesus' commentary is to prove that the religious leaders use their own traditions as an excuse for not following God's law, Jesus also shows that honoring our fathers and mothers is a significant commandment and a way of honoring God. Watson Mills points out that as children in Sunday school, we are often taught that honoring our father and mother means to obey their rules and respect them. But the way Jesus portrays it is more as a command for adult children, of honoring their parents by caring for them in their old age. We also see examples of care for older members of society throughout Scripture. In what Amy Hall describes as a powerfully prophetic act, Ruth leaves her homeland and family in order to faithfully care for her otherwise abandoned mother-in-law, Naomi. Jesus himself makes a point of providing care for his mother as one of his last requests. In John 19, Jesus makes a final appeal in the midst of his crucifixion by asking one of his disciples to care for his mother Mary as the disciple's own mother. Scripture tells us that the disciple took Mary into his home. Jesus ensured that in his absence, his mother would be cared for. Evidence of care and inclusion of the elderly are also provided by the early church. The Christian community in Acts was dedicated to protecting their vulnerable members, including the elderly. In fact, one of the very first disagreements within the early church, recorded in Acts 6, was how to best provide for widows in the community. At the same time, the church embraced the widows and the contribution they made to the community. As Cavani points out in her study of widows in the early church, the Christian community offered solidarity to the widows by extending membership. So we have now connected the dots between the challenges that the elderly in America face today and how Scripture and Christian tradition call us to address care for the elderly. The question that we are now compelled to answer is, what can I do? What can you do? And what can we do together as a Christian community? For 2 of my years at college, I worked part-time as an activities assistant in a nursing home facility. I spent many hours simply visiting with elderly residents and began to realize the simple yet profound joy of being in relationship. I pushed wheelchairs so that elderly residents could breathe the fresh air and see the spring flowers. I witnessed the spark in the eyes of residents as they told stories from the good old days. I was the voice softly singing Amazing Grace as an elderly resident with no nearby family took her final breaths. These are actions we can all take, simple gestures that allow us to be in purposeful relationship with the elderly we know. We should integrate the elderly into our communities and recognize the contributions that they have to offer. Older people have so much experience and wisdom to share. We can serve the older generation in ways that reduce the physical barriers of old age through simple tasks like mowing an elderly person's lawn, setting up their Christmas tree, or taking them to church on Sunday morning. We must be especially mindful of finding ways to honor our family members as they age. And yet, in this age of mobility, when children and grandchildren may not live nearby, the church can act as a family. Our churches should be attentive to the elderly in their midst and find ways to meet the physical, social, and vocational barriers of their members. Yes, the older generations do face many challenges, and the increasing number of elderly will only further highlight them. But we are a people called by God to live at peace with one another, to show justice to the vulnerable, and to bring wholeness to our communities. We can follow God's call by bridging the divide and bringing the elderly back into their vital place in community. We can live at peace by seeking justice from generation to generation.
Our second contestant is Joel Nofziger, and his speech is entitled Confession as a Restorative Practice for the Church.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. These are not words most of us will hear on a Sunday morning. They belong to a distant form of church and a far-off conviction. Mennonite tradition is more in line with the question, are you at peace with God and neighbor? Confession, in the most basic definition, is acknowledging harm oneself as inflicted on another and asking for forgiveness. In the practice of this, there is an elemental power. It binds the community together. Confession is mutual accountability within the church. We have lost this from our tradition, and the church needs to relearn the power of true confession and reintegrate it into congregational life. The essence of confession is tangible repentance and forgiveness. It is a spiritual discipline that has concrete action attached to it, a change of spirit and behavior. The subject of confession is individual or communal sin, sin being an action or mindset that harms relationship with God or neighbor. And the role of this ritual is to bring these harmful tendencies to the fore so that they may be addressed and corrected. Confession has fallen from favor for 3 major reasons, 2 cultural and 1 ecclesiastic. First, we are living in an individualistic society. This should come as no surprise. Look at the messages around us. Advertisers sell objects and pleasures because they will make us the individual feel good. When people tell us what we need to be successful, it is us as individuals, not a group. This is obvious for men, but for women it is slightly more complicated. For them, success is usually portrayed as having a partner and a family. But this is still individualistic because it objectifies family and relationships as tools for personal pleasure, not as communities. This whole thing is nothing new either. Frederick Jackson Turner noted in 1921 that conditions on the frontier led to individualism because population was too dispersed for social institutions to be effective. He also marked this individualism as a driving force in shaping American culture. With individualism came the adoration of self-sufficiency, and the community became less and less necessary. Even after institutions formed, this mindset was preserved, integrated into the American psyche. Secondly, American culture, with its individualistic tones, has formed with a high Christology while not placing as much emphasis on ecclesiology. Worship services are shaped around Jesus and relationship to him rather than the rituals of the church. And these rituals include confession, which is denigrated to a prayer here or a reading there, maybe with a call and response or a blessing at the end. Most importantly of all, confession has been practiced badly by the church. Turning through the martyr's mirror, one finds countless stories of people of confession gone astray, people being given the option to repent or be slain. This is not to imply that confession gone wrong is a Catholic thing. Anabaptists are just as guilty. Two of the early Anabaptist Confession of Faith, the Dordrecht Confession of Faith, and the Schleitheim Brotherly Union, contain both the promise of healthy confession and the seed of abuse in their articles on the ban. Under these articles, a member of the church who persists in error is to be banned or shunned from the community. While there is nothing wrong with the text, individuals who later read them took the authority to ban members and used it to enhance their own personal power or enforce sectarian codes. Now, because of stories like this, we tend to view church discipline as a retributive model. We hear the phrases church discipline, shunning, or confession, and we conjure up the image of an old bishop preaching fire and damnation. While this may be representative of the church in some times and places, that is not how it should be. Within the church, the process of correction is meant to be restorative. In 1527, the believers who wrote the Schleitheim Confession understood this when they let confession happen before communion, so that we may all in one spirit and in one love break and eat from one bread and drink from one cup. They understood that confession was meant to gather the disparate members of the congregation, address the conflicts between them, and unify them as the body of Christ. More than 100 years later, in 1632, the composers of the Dordrecht Confession still understood this, as they saw confession as symbolic of a rejoining of the church. The 1995 Confession of Faith in a Mennonite Perspective is explicit about this. Corrective discipline in the church should be exercised in a redemptive manner. This is in line with the biblical teaching of shalom, right relationship with God and neighbor. It is also in line with the values of restorative justice, which is not surprising, for restorative justice, as explained by Howard Zaire, is also rooted in shalom. In this view, justice looks to foster restitution and healing. The harm needs to be repaired, most definitely, but the victim, the offender, and the community all need to be rebuilt and restored. The harmed need justice. They need the opportunity to share their story and be heard, the opportunity to be reassured, the opportunity to be supported. The one who harmed also needs justice, the opportunity to make things right, the opportunity to be changed, the opportunity to be supported. Both need to repair the relationship between them. For all, harmed, harmer, and the community that enfolds, future needs must be considered. When done correctly, confession does all of this. There are three essential parts to the ritual of confession that I want to delineate. First, there is a statement of wrongdoing. When speaking of confession, we usually stop here. An individual who feels they have done harm acknowledges what they have done before the community. The feeling of conviction can be purely individual, or members of the same congregation can approach the offender and speak with them about it. It is absolutely crucial that the choice to confess is voluntary. At the same time the offender confesses, those harmed should have the opportunity to respond with how they were affected. The congregation should affirm the victim that wrong was done to them, and the offender that it was good for them to take responsibility. After oral confession comes penance, where the offender does what is required to make things right. This is not meant as punishment, but restoration. Penance should answer the question, what is needed to help the harmed individual and the damaged community? The exact nature varies on what was committed. All those who feel involved in the incident should be able to state what they feel they need. Now, the final aspect of confession is forgiveness. After an individual has confessed and is in the process of penance, the community is obligated to extend welcome to the offender. Here, then, is a restorative model of church discipline encapsulated in the ritual of confession. With its three aspects, it gives victims justice by providing an opportunity for compensation, affirming that wrong was done to them, and by giving them support in community. The offenders also receive justice, for they own their harm, they have the opportunity to make things right, and they are not cast out of the community. The congregation itself also receives justice, for through the process of confession, it becomes at peace with itself. For this reason, it is crucial that confession reasserts itself as a key ritual within our churches.
Our third presenter is Taylor Weidman, and his title is Dissimilarity is Hope.
As a community dedicated to peace, we must not use or internalize the methods of measurement and conformity. As a community of learners and teachers, we cannot let ourselves become reduced to merely cogs in a system of compulsion, to judging our neighbors on how well they fit or how adequate we are. As community in search of justice, desiring of mercy, and journeying together in humility, it is important that we put first the call to peace within our own walls, families, and classrooms, through acceptance, even reliance on the dissimilarities between us. Only when we grasp the strength of dissimilarity will we be able to live out Christ's call to the way of peace and neighborly love. My story is about dyslexia. I was diagnosed with dyslexia when I was in first grade. I experienced trouble in school because I couldn't read like the rest of my class. I would sit down every day, dreading the reading circle, stumbling around when it came my turn. Early in first grade, my teacher, Ms. Cumbo, talked to my parents about the possibility of dyslexia. After I underwent psychological testing, I was indeed diagnosed with dyslexia. My parents pulled me out of first grade and started homeschooling. Shame. I felt deep shame when my friends could read and I couldn't. Shame. They were better than me and I knew it. My story is about privilege. I am not an underdog. My family was rich enough to pull me out of public school. My family was educated enough to find resources about dyslexia. My family was connected enough to make alternative education possible. Most people can't tell I have dyslexia. This is not about those, like me, who can stand in front of you with a written speech and ask for voice. This is about how we approach dissimilarity as a community. Dyslexia is probably not what you think it is. It's a symptom of a functional difference in brain structure, not a deficiency of neurons. Right now, most of you have an internal monologue. Most people think in words. Dyslexics don't do this. Dyslexic thought is primarily nonverbal, beginning with images. Words need translated to and from thought. Right now, I'm reading from this paper, translating into an image, and translating back into words. This takes a lot of thought, so excuse me for stumbling. The dyslexic mind is formed in babies around 3 months old. At this time, dyslexics develop a mental trick referred to as disorienting. Remember this. Babies have limited vision when they are young, so when a parent reaches into the crib, the baby first sees the fingertips, then a hand, the arm, and finally a face. Most babies see it exactly as it happens. Babies developing dyslexia don't do this. The disorienting trick allows the baby to take all the memories of the parent reaching into the crib and put them together. When the dyslexic baby sees the parent's face, sees the parent's hand, he also sees a face. Disorienting becomes so successful that the child never develops the need for verbal thought. I'm not really sure how they figured this out, but psychologists think that nonverbal thought happens 400 to 2,000 times faster than verbal thought. Babies who can disorient don't develop a need to think in words, a difficulty when it comes time to learn to read. Dyslexia has substantial weaknesses, but also substantial gifts. Dyslexics can synthesize a great deal of information very quickly because nonverbal thought is hundreds of times faster. Dyslexics also have the potential for deep creativity because nonverbal thought is also nonlinear. To back up this point, Henry Ford, Alexander Graham Bell, Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein, Winston Churchill, and John F. Kennedy are a few of the most famous dyslexics of recent time. Excuse me that they're all men. These people used the gift of dyslexia to shape the world we know, but had trouble with rote systems, quoting Einstein. One had to cram all this stuff into one's mind for the examinations, whether one liked it or not. This coercion had such a deterring effect on me that after I had passed the final examination, I found the consideration of any scientific problems distasteful to me for an entire year. So what does any of this have to do with peace in our communities? Measures, conformity, inadequacy, shame. We have a choice as a peace community and academic institution. Either we measure and shame the dissimilarities within us, or we embrace the gifts alongside the weaknesses of our neighbors. This is not just about learning disabilities. I use dyslexia only as an example. This is about recognition of difference. We must not allow measurements to determine our worth. We must not allow the shame of inadequacy to pervade our community and institution. James Gilligan writes convincingly from 25 years of experience in prisons about the power of shame. He writes that shame is the driver of destructive conflict, that respect, looking back at the other's eye, seeing the other as equal, is not only good, but is fundamental to peace in communities. The way we treat dissimilarities in our community is a foundational part of our peace stance. How we treat dissimilarities exposes the truth behind what we profess as our peace ethic. I ask that dissimilarities within our community and academic institution be treated as strength instead of virus, be respected instead of shamed. My story of dyslexia and shame persists even here at EMU. I took a stats class last spring and had a lot of trouble. This class was well structured, but I couldn't seem to make sense of the meanings or understand the ideas. I was struggling while many other students were succeeding and enjoying the class. If this has happened to you, empathize with me now. I couldn't fit the structure of the class, and I didn't feel comfortable purposefully deviating or labeling myself as dissimilar. There were two options: shame in perceived dissimilarity, or shame in academic inadequacy. Shame at either turn. I chose to hide and almost failed the class. In measuring ourselves, we discipline ourselves. I told myself to suck it up, punish my weak parts into submission, to work harder, with more focus, with less sleep, with narrower gaze. No longer did I need the grades to spur me on. I was my own spur. I had ingested the measures of the class, and I was inadequate. This is about shame. We cannot fit dissimilar people into standardized molds without shame. This is taking a personal risk. I only started telling people about dyslexia a few months ago, and only after I felt recognized on campus. I don't know how people will treat me as dyslexic. But I hope as a community, we can learn to embrace our dissimilarities as gift and weakness, not shame. This is strength. It is important that we allow dissimilar gifts and weaknesses to be revealed without rejection. It is important that we allow dissimilarities to be seen without shame. The gifts and weaknesses of dissimilarity in our community and institution is strength. We have a choice at every junction in our lives. As a peace community and academic institution, we can label the dyslexic, the minority, the gay as dissimilar and inadequate, finding better treatments for the problem people. Or we can embrace their differences, embrace our differences as strength. Dissimilarity becoming hope starts with ourselves, starts with realizing that dissimilarity is not shameful, starts with becoming vulnerable to our own gifts and weaknesses. Dissimilarity becoming hope starts with our communities, starts with allowing for expression of dissimilar gifts without shame. Starts with embracing our neighbors as dissimilar and therefore important. Let us invade our peace community and our academic institution with this hope.
Our fourth presenter is Jamila Whitmer, and her speech is entitled, His Dream is Our Command, Breaking Stereotypes.
In 1963, a man named Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of a dream of harmony, equality, and the end of stereotypes. Nearly 50 years later, some progress has been made. Racial discrimination is illegal, interracial marriages are legal, and overt racism is largely invisible. Because of this, many believe racism is no longer an issue. They believe that King's I Have a Dream speech marked the end of racism in America. It cannot be denied that King's work had a huge impact on ethnicity relations in the United States. However, it also cannot be denied that there is a long way to go. While structural factors play a large role in this issue, I would like to argue that it is the job of the church to lead the movement towards reconciliation and harmony on the individual level. Why do I say there's a long way to go? Racism in contemporary American culture is subtle enough that it can go unnoticed unless you look for it. But take a minute to think about it. Look around a wealthy suburban community and you see mostly Americans of European descent. Walk around in an inner city high school and you see a disproportionate number of minority students. Step into a church and you likely see people who all look more or less the same and have similar worldviews. Is this segregation a problem? Is it possible we are just separate but equal? Many would agree that separate but equal did not work in the 1950s, and I would argue the same is true now. Not only do the stereotypes associated with certain skin tones cause problems for many people, but the fact that we are separate prevents any of us from understanding this issue in its entirety. The lack of interaction creates space for stereotypes to take root and for people to be seen as merely members of a group with certain characteristics rather than as individuals. Stereotypes often result in self-fulfilling prophecies, low self-esteem, and racial profiling. Recently, I had a conversation with some friends from my Spanish-speaking church that exposed me to the reality of racial profiling. We were talking about dumpster diving and whether it is legal. At one point, I commented that I have never been caught. A friend responded, "Yeah, you can get away with it," suggesting that as a Hispanic man, he is more likely to be targeted by law enforcement. In that moment, I realized how much of an issue racial profiling is. A college-age white female jumping into a dumpster apparently seems less suspicious than a Hispanic or African American doing the exact same thing. Whites obviously enjoy a certain amount of privilege in the United States. We are more likely to get a college education, more likely to be middle class, less likely to get pulled over for speeding, less likely to be associated with danger. But racism also affects white people in a negative way. As Beverly Tatum recognizes in her book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria?, whites generally have one of two responses to white privilege. Either they are completely ignorant of it, or they feel guilty. Neither of these responses is a good thing. We must move past both ignorance and guilt in order to work towards justice. Speaking as a white person to a largely white audience, I want to recognize that there are negative stereotypes of people of all backgrounds. One time I was walking with five other white people and a Dominican in the inner city of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in an area dominated by African Americans and Hispanics. It was pretty late at night, and at one point we passed a man who saw the color of our skin and remarked, "Y'all lost?" Then he saw my Dominican friend and said, "Oh, you have a tour guide." As white people, we should not have been in the lower class neighborhood. But the presence of our Dominican friend, on the other hand, was not surprising. In New York City, a woman I know moved into the South Bronx and tried to get to know her neighbors by having weekly cookouts during the summer. It took several weeks before any of the neighbors dared to eat or drink anything because, since she and her husband were white, the assumption was that they had poisoned the Kool-Aid. These are the kinds of stereotypes we need to work against. The stereotype that white people do not care about minorities is based in the history of the white flight. We need to not only fight the stereotypes that some white people have of minorities, but also the stereotypes that some minorities have of white people. So how do we do this? Stories like the Good Samaritan show us how to treat people who are different from us. Commands like love your neighbor tell us to treat people well. But what does the Bible say about integrating? I would like to begin by addressing the somewhat cliche question of what would Jesus do? The story in John 4 about Jesus talking with a Samaritan woman is one of my favorite Bible stories. Jesus went out of his way to acknowledge a woman who was marginalized by her community and who was, by all biblical standards, a sinner. The story tells us to show acceptance, love, and mercy, even to sinners. Something that often goes unnoticed, however, is that Jesus was crossing racial barriers. Most Jews of his day would not have even entered the region of Samaria, but Jesus went there intentionally. He refused to give in to the fear and prejudice of his compatriots against the Samaritans. As followers of Christ, we must be intentional about going into the inner cities and places where people are marginalized. We must be intentional about putting ourselves in positions to cross those racial barriers that define much of our society. Jesus also expressed a desire for integration in his prayer for the church in John 17. In verse 21, he prays for believers, that all of them may be one. The representation of the church in Acts 2 fulfills this prayer. According to Acts 2, verse 5, there was a gathering of God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. Prophecies in Revelation also call for this kind of diversity in the church. Furthermore, Galatians 3:28 states that there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. So the Bible is pretty clear about how Jesus and the early church dealt with racial and ethnic differences. Now, what do these principles look like in 21st century America? The first thing we need to do is integrate. The churches we attend too often reflect our theology and background exactly. The people we go to church with look and think like us. Not only should we be intentional about which churches we go to, but churches must be intentional about being open to people from all backgrounds. They should not work between diverse churches, or even merge churches, as in the case of Norristown New Life, which is a merged church that is referenced in the book Enter the River by Jody Miller Shearer. Once we integrate, we must listen. We must listen to the stories of hurt and frustration. We must learn to know people for who they are. We must tell our own stories and share our pain. Listening to the stories from my friends and my church is how I have learned about racial profiling. These open discussions are the only way healing can happen, and it is the only way stereotypes are broken. It is not necessarily comfortable, I know that. But comfort is not the concern. It does not really matter whether it is comfortable. What matters is whether we are willing to be uncomfortable to follow Christ in the truest way possible. Perfect love drives out fear. This does not necessarily mean that we will not have fear, but that we will overcome fear for the sake of love. So I challenge you to be the change you want to see. I challenge you to work towards Dr. King's dream. There is so much hurt in this area, and there are many stereotypes. Many of us do not talk about racism because we are afraid of offending people or exacerbating the pain that already exists. But I challenge you to break the stereotypes. God is Rapha, our healer. Only through his power can healing occur when it comes to racial injustice. But we as the church are called to be God's hands and feet in the world. So think about it. What is your role in breaking down stereotypes? What will you do to be intentional about hearing the stories and understanding the experiences of others? What are you willing to risk to follow the example of Jesus?
Our fifth presenter is Rose Beiler, and her speech is entitled Living Into the Tension: Social Services and Systemic Change.
You are profiting off of poverty. Coming from African American community organizers who had spent their lives fighting for justice and systemic change, this was hard to hear. My classmates and I had just heard these men present on their organization and were going around with our names and majors when they found out that three of us were social work majors, and they really got interested. They asked us to define social work and explain to them what social workers do. We whipped out our professional jargon, rattling off something about empowerment, service, dignity and worth of the person, strength-based perspective, and probably some other things. I thought we would have made our professors proud, but they didn't seem to agree. They believed that social work as a profession creates dependencies and enforces the inequalities in our social structure. We argued back and forth about the strengths and weaknesses of the profession of social work, and then they got down to the base of the issue: you're profiting off of poverty. They believed that the social work profession couldn't really be interested in social change because it's in our best interest, financially and in terms of job security, to continue the cycle of poverty. Our brief but passionate disagreement exposed underlying differences in our approaches to social change. The community organizers were focusing on long-term structural change through capacity building, while still trying to address individuals' needs. They saw social work as too often improving the lives of individuals while ignoring structural injustice, rendering the individual work futile. The other social work majors and I recognized this tension, but hoped, and still hope, that social work has the potential to work in the lives of individuals while keeping the bigger picture in mind, working as allies with communities and individuals to bring equal access and say in institutions they're part of, even while helping them meet their immediate needs. Everyone there agreed that systems are broken, and that individuals sometimes need help and support while the injustices of the system are being addressed. The question is how we do all that. In this speech, I'll share with you one way that I've seen social services detracting from social change, much in the way these community organizers would have expected, and one way that I've seen social services working with individuals and communities, emphasizing community strengths to create social change. I'll touch on broader policy-level issues and also examine how Christianity can be an impetus for social service work focused on social change. In order to do all these things, I'll need to simplify matters, but I'll try and not simplify away the important parts. First, social workers do get bogged down running the system and forget that we're actually supposed to be critiquing it, too. One example comes from my experiences last semester as a medical case management intern working with HIV-positive women at the Women's Collective in DC. At the Women's Collective, we used an educational program called Willow, put out by the CDC, Center for Disease Control. The program's aim is to decrease HIV transmission by empowering HIV-positive women. The program educates about HIV, safer sex, gender pride, support networks, and lots of other things. However, this program, designed to create long-lasting change through empowering women, can have some degrading aspects. Willow had standardized intake forms, pretests, post-tests, and session evaluations for the four sessions provided by the CDC. I'd start out by asking a client if she'd like to do the intake forms herself or together. Deborah said, "Well, I can't write very well, so it's best if you just ask me the questions." The very first question, then, was age, which got some women defensive right from the start. "Well, I don't like to talk about it, but I'm already 62. Then we asked about employment status. "No, I'm not working right now." "Monthly income?" "Well, there's the $664 from Social Security, and then I also get $16 a month for food stamps." "Level of education completed?" "Only the 10th grade." And it just kept going. Then we continued on with the pretest, which asked questions like, "How many times in the past year have you exchanged sex for drugs and/or money?" Although there were times when Deborah laughed and blushed at the detail of the questions, her body became more slouched and she became more dejected as the interview went on. The program, though, absolutely ignored this dehumanizing effect. It's a program designed to empower women, but it starts by lining up all of the ways that society has labeled them failures. With the Willow program, did we build community or did we point out a deficiency and provide our own cookie-cutter fix? The program did educate and probably had an overall positive effect, but at what cost? While this is an example of how social services can lose sight of the big picture of social change, let me share an example of a program that I think really did help empower women for lasting change by beginning with their strengths. When I think about the strength perspective in the Women's Collective, I immediately think of the community health workers. These are women who began as clients at the Women's Collective and with some training have stayed on with the organization to work as peers even after they no longer need case management services. They provide intensive attention to women who are out of care or at high risk for one reason or another, including recently diagnosed women. They accompany women to appointments, call them with medication reminders, walk them through prescription pickup, and lots of other things. Through this intensive work, they support the women to the point where the women are more comfortable doing these things on their own and begin to see their own capabilities more clearly. The community health workers generally started out in a pretty rough place. Sabrina was hospitalized and very ill while dealing with her recent diagnosis and caring for her three children. But these women were able to build on their own strengths to the point where they're now working with the Women's Collective in a paid position with input into their colleagues' work. These women challenge the injustices in society not through policy-level changes, but through empowering others and building on the strengths that already exist within the community, while also helping provide needed services to individuals. This is real change. The same question of services versus systemic change applies on a broader policy level, too. I'm focusing more on individual-level work because that's my experience. But the broader level is just as important. In many ways, social programs and policies do perpetuate oppression and need. They highlight people's needs, thereby bringing on dependency and victimization. So, how do we do public policy in a way that encourages social change? Well, that's the topic of another speech, and I'm not going to pretend like I'm an expert on the topic. One thing I would suggest is the importance of including in the formation of policy the people who it will directly affect. This is important from free and reduced lunches in Harrisonburg all the way to water purification in Zambia. This type of communication is often assumed in the US and on a broader scale, but is also surprisingly lacking in many situations. While many wonderful people do good work in social service areas without a faith background, I believe that adding faith to the mix takes these questions to a whole new level. After all, we're commanded repeatedly in the Bible to do things like do justice, love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. And the narrative I read in the Bible shows a Jesus who confronts oppression and often upsets the social and religious status quo. Now, I know that not everyone reads their Bible that way, but I can't really address that right now, so we'll just pretend like everybody thinks the way I do. This call to action that I read in the Bible can be a great motivator for our churches to do all sorts of good work. But our churches are often guilty of the same shortcomings of secular organizations when it comes to social services and social change. In his article, Why Servanthood is Bad, John McKnight forms this into a question addressing church service organizations. He asks, quote, "Have they substituted the vision of service for the only thing that will make people whole, community? Are they service peddlers or community builders?" He goes on to make the same charges as the community organizers I first mentioned, critiquing the ways funding relegated to those in poverty is spent. Service peddlers soak up money into their services, paying for social workers like me. So the question remains, in both Christian and secular organizations, how do we do service in a way that doesn't preclude community, but instead builds communities to take on oppressive power structures? Our Christianity provides us with a strong rootedness in our social change efforts, so we have to keep facing the questions and tensions involved. This puzzle of how to fit a broader and long-term vision of social change into our day-to-day activities is not limited to a single issue like AIDS in DC or water purification in Zambia. As such, there's no blanket call to action, but the call to live in the tension of opposing right answers, providing for immediate needs, and working for broader social justice. We all want world peace, and we all want to make the world a better place, but different people do this in different ways. I challenge us to use our gifts to empower individuals, communities, and policy-making bodies in ways that confront systemic injustice and shift towards sustainable change. We must not forget the end goal. In working with individuals, always keep one eye on the bigger picture and work toward policy change or empowering individuals while you work to provide needed services, even if this is just congratulating a woman on her 62 years when she's feeling ashamed of her age. In policy work, our task is the opposite, to always keep one eye on the people, one foot on the ground. Living in this tension isn't a comfortable place to live. It means constant questioning and second guessing. But living in this tension is exactly what we're called to do as Christians and peace builders charged with birthing new systems and lighting new lights, as Shirley Irina Murray wrote in her lyrics. In whatever work we do, our challenge is to examine what service means and if it is sustainable. We must ask ourselves, do our larger scale social change efforts reflect the individual needs of the people, and do our service to individuals strengthen and empower them to claim a place in society for themselves? Thank you.
Our sixth presenter is Thomas Millery, and his speech is entitled "A Pluralistic Realm: Towards a Theology of Peace."
There can be no doubt that peacebuilding is a concept with a strong theological component. Those wishing to cultivate an ethic of peace in the world must be prepared to explore ideas of peace concerning every level of human existence, including the spiritual. Throughout history, numerous religious traditions have attempted to promote both active peacebuilding and a theology of peace. Perhaps none has become so polarized in this pursuit as Christianity, which has both a rich tradition of prophetic peacebuilding and a tendency to be co-opted by royalist ideologies of dominance and imperialism. To build true peace in a world torn apart by countless ideologies of dogmatic exclusivism, Christianity must embrace a radical theology of pluralistic grace. Within Christianity, spiritual pluralism is often rejected in favor of absolutist claims concerning the nature of reality. From the dawn of human self-consciousness, religion has attempted to ease the trauma of existence by replacing life's inherent element of unknowing with assuring claims of absolute truth. We can see throughout history motivations for this behavior that range from the desire for power and control to genuine attempts to ease human suffering through faith. Indeed, many modern Christians who espouse their faith as an exclusivist supernatural framework are trying very sincerely to ease human suffering through faith. The problem with this is that Christianity as a singular explanation of reality is not a product that can successfully bring peace to modern societies or individuals. Because unsustainable truth claims are no longer any kind of good news in a world where the gaps in our knowledge, where we once believed God dwelled, are rapidly receding. There is a reason that the number of secularists in America has doubled in the past 3 decades, and that the National Academy of Sciences is now almost entirely devoid of Christian members. For the Christian faith to continue on this path is to doom itself to irrelevance and to waste its inspired traditions and writings. Worst of all, it will completely fail to bring any kind of true and lasting peace in the world. However, while the world may not need or desire another faith espousing dogmatic exclusivism, there is no shortage of need in the world for communities of acceptance and love. It becomes evident that the relevance of Christianity to modern society is not as a competitor with other faiths vying for greater numbers, that it is as a prophetic voice for desperately needed peace and for grace. Such grace can be found in some of the writings of Paul, referred to by some theologians as the father of universalism. We learn in Philippians 2, 6 and 7 that even though Paul considered Jesus to be the ultimate embodiment of divinity, he also saw Jesus as seeking to make himself nothing rather than grasp for equality of God. The spiritual peace of Christianity therefore comes not from a promise of equality with God, possession of the greatest religion, but rather from the embrace of humility and recognition of our common humanity. If the grace of Christ is great enough that the deep societal divisions of Jew and Gentile, slave and free, male and female become insignificant, as stated in Galatians 3:28, are we really to believe that it is right that the world remains sharply divided along the lines of Christian, atheist, Muslim, Buddhist, and every other faith and philosophy? Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote that the Pauline issue of whether circumcision is necessary for justification can be translated into a modern context as whether religion is necessary for salvation. Perhaps spiritual peace can be found if Christianity truly embraces the idea of pluralistic spirituality, where salvation is discovered amongst a community of diverse identities and we encounter the other with minds of openness and eyes of grace. I've recently had opportunities to witness the power of pluralistic grace firsthand. During the Mountain Justice Y trip to Appalachia in Southwest Virginia over spring break, a member of our group led a workshop on anarcho-primitivism and the Bible. A lot of the environmental activists gathered at Mountain Justice adhered to philosophies of secularism or animism, yet many showed strong interest in the workshop. The workshop was a humble presentation of the biblical inspirations for ideas of liberation, justice, and embrace of nature. The response to it was fascinating. Several of the attendees stated how they had been turned away from Christianity by the conservative interpretations they had previously grown up with or been exposed to, but loved the thought of the ideas that they lived for being present within the Bible. What I saw in that workshop was the beauty of contrasting ideologies, humbly encountering each other with a willingness to learn and to grow. My experience this semester of helping to organize a club called Freethought Coalition, which meets for honest conversation about spirituality and philosophy through a lens of logic and rationality, and for free jello, has been enlightening for me. While part of the intention for the club is to have a space for expressions of non-Christian spirituality, I have had multiple Christian friends who attend tell me how much those discussions have benefited them in their own faith journeys. While having honest conversation about issues as controversial as religious differences is not always easy or comfortable, honestly encountering the worldviews of those we may feel we have little in common with is an essential step for humans seeking to live together in true peace. Such graceful encounters are desperately needed in a world where religious and ideological differences breed deep division, resentment, and all too often, violence. While I see little hope for peace in the world coming from a gospel that claims all other paths are inherently defective or unjustified, I see much in the Christian tradition that those who claim that identity can draw upon in the prophetic pursuit of a pluralistic theology. In the second chapter of Ephesians, there are many powerful statements concerning the unity that Jews and Gentiles experience together through Christ. No longer Jew and Gentile, no longer atheist and theist, no longer Christian and non-Christian. This is obviously not to state that these identities will literally cease to exist, but that these divides are now insignificant when measured against the grace and the peace available to us all. Another beautiful biblical image of a world completely flowing with grace and peace is shown in the book of Revelation, City of God, where even the defeated kings of the earth are present and the gates are never closed. If we are really to believe the teachings of Jesus that the realm of God is a reign of peace and grace, then we must work from across ideological lines to experience hope and growth from our daily encounters with each other. Far from sacrificing the realm of God that Jesus declared to be at hand, an embrace of pluralism would fulfill an idea that Jesus repeated many, many times, that the realm of God belongs to the outsiders, the wanderers, and the strangers. Can it really be claimed that a theology of Christian peacebuilding can allow for any condemnation of another's lifestyle or eternal soul because they are walking a spiritual path that looks different than what is familiar? A theology of pluralism is not a relativistic denial of differences, but an acknowledgement of the peace that comes from gracefully exploring and growing in those differences, as deep as they may be. These changes in theology are urgently needed in the world. In the last decade alone, there have been countless acts of violence and war in the world justified by dogmatic religious claims. As we continue to seek truth together and work towards a world of peace, we must remember our shared human experience is where the immanence or transcendence we see in the world shines the brightest. As we work as peace builders, we must utter a prophetic no to both physical violence of oppression and warfare and the spiritual violence of exclusivism and dogmatism. Through this, we will discover the realm of God that is present within our midst when we have the courage to truly act towards grace and towards love. As John Caputo brilliantly states, the only ones who end up left out of the realm of God are the insiders who never really understood the invitation or took it to heart. It is time to take Jesus at his word and see the realm is at hand and the gates of the city are open. Jews and Gentiles, men and women, theists and atheists, all engaging together in the unending spiritual path towards truth. William Connolly beautifully describes such a reality in his work, A World of Becoming, saying, "You and I are drops in the sea of flows, feelings, and surges, my friend. So, if you die before you wake, well, I pray your God your soul to take." Let us have the grace to envision this world, and from within the pluralistic realm of experience and transformation, together, build peace.
Our seventh presenter is Julia Schmidt, and her presentation is entitled Holding Dignity in the Community of Faith.
Dignity, the quality or state of being worthy, honored, or esteemed. Most people would say they understand the word dignity, but fail to recognize dignity as more than respect, but a birthright all humans have, as Donna Hicks explains in her book, Dignity. The book lays out 10 essential elements of dignity: acceptance of identity, inclusion, safety, acknowledgement, recognition, fairness, benefit of the doubt, understanding, independence, and accountability. When one of these 10 elements is violated, anger and withdrawal often occur. Since dignity is essential for all humans, it needs to be demonstrated within the community of faith. Today, I want to share with you two experiences of mine, which have led me to a new concept of what peace can look like within the church, and how the concept of dignity can transform the way we live in relationship as a community of faith. My first story comes from the congregation I was a member of from middle school until high school graduation. This large congregation had a wide range of strongly differing theological beliefs and doctrines. Many people in the congregation believed that theologically there are very little gray areas. And if you questioned their beliefs, you were seen as wrong for even raising the questions. These differing beliefs, although they had always been present, had often been shoved under a mat and were rarely discussed. However, halfway through my junior year in high school, these differences were brought to the forefront as a new pastor came into the congregation. Meetings were held about the direction that the community of faith should be taking. Instead of productive conversation and deep listening to each other about the different opinions and doctrines, people literally yelled their beliefs to the whole congregation and refused to listen to those with a different point of view. People tried to get their point and agenda across without any respect to those whom they were hurting. I was confused and angry. I could not understand how people who were supposed to be my faith family could treat their fellow church members so badly. I was hurt and broken by the experience, and for a time lost all hope in the church. After high school graduation, my family moved to a different state, left that congregation, and I came here to my university. Then last summer, I needed a summer job, but I also wanted to use the summer to reconnect and find a different vision of church than that which I had experienced. I decided to participate in the Ministry Inquiry Program. Through the Ministry Inquiry Program, I ended up in a large city in Texas at a congregation of about 75 attendees. I had never been to Texas before and knew very little about the church before going. However, I talked on the phone with the pastor and learned that the congregation was not experiencing conflict and was open to different theologies, the two essential elements to my search of possible placements. Once in Texas, the pastor explained to me how as the only Mennonite church in the area, it attracted many different people who would not normally worship together if they live in an area such as Harrisonburg, Virginia, which has a large variety of Mennonite churches. Now, I'm not going to pretend that there were no problems in the church with regard to differing theologies. But instead of destructive conflict like in my previous congregation, I experienced something completely different. Near the beginning of my summer, I became part of a small group of women from the congregation who were reading The Heart of Christianity by Marcus Borg. For those who are not familiar with the book, Borg presents a liberal theological reading of Jesus and the Bible. Some in the book study related very closely with this theology, while others were in complete opposition to some of the ideas expressed in the book. With a wide range of opinions, I expected people to become defensive, especially those whose beliefs were being questioned by the author of the book. However, this did not happen. Instead of becoming defensive, this group of women opened up with each other and me as they expressed their feelings and beliefs, while being open to hearing a new point of view. At the end of the book, they agreed to disagree with each other, but all felt closer to each other and had a greater understanding and respect of their differing beliefs. They demonstrated that fostering a good relationship with each other and respecting each other's different beliefs was more important than trying to persuade and change each other's views. This group of women was not the exception in this Texas congregation. Throughout the entire church, I found a deep respect for one another and all different types of views. For the attendees of the church, having a correct doctrine and being theologically correct was not the most important thing. Instead, for them, they believed to be Christ's true body and live in close community with one another meant living in right relationships. I believe it was because of this attitude that there was not much conflict. Instead of spending energy on fighting, people were able to get engaged in church life and the surrounding community, working to spread peace around the world. So, what was the difference between this Texas congregation and my church growing up? Why was one able to create peace, while in the other, conflict just festered and grew? I believe one answer to this question comes from the intentionality that existed in Texas. The Texas church was a smaller community that spent a lot of time with each other, inside of church and out. I spent many evenings that summer going to members' houses for parties and informal get-togethers. In many ways, they remind me of the early church in Acts. Acts 2, verses 42 through 47 says, "They devoted themselves to the apostles, teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people." This is how the church in Texas acted. Every time I met with people, I felt their sincere hearts and truly joyful praise. Their intentionality about spending time together, praying together, often sharing meals together, serving the poor and needy together, and even figuring out the finances of the church together, led to a body that knew each other extremely well and was able to see each other's humanity in order to work out differences better, leading to a more peaceful community despite the differences that existed. In Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove's book, New Monasticism, he describes how the early church in Acts also had divisive issues. Throughout the New Testament, you see divisions such as Jew and Gentile. However, this early church was able to find unity despite the differences. Hartgrove writes, "Unity across dividing lines was what distinguished the early church, so much so that they required a new name. The name Christian was a word that this new body of believers decided to call themselves. Being intentional about being the church despite differences is what being Christian is all about. Looking back on my two experiences, I believe that dignity is the difference. In my old church, people did not respect each other's dignity. I know my own dignity was violated. I did not feel that my identity was accepted. I did not feel safe, included, acknowledged, or even recognized. I most definitely did not feel understood. And when one person's dignity was violated, often in response, in their anger and frustration, people violated someone else's dignity. Now, I don't think the people in the church were bad people or they meant to harm each other in the way they did. However, the church did not understand dignity and how dignity is essential to all humans, and especially when attempting to be a community of Christ. Texas was different because through their intentionality, they are able to hold each other's dignity. Within their conversations and actions, the congregation was able to embrace one another and respect the essential elements of dignity. By holding each other's dignity, I believe the church can be transformed and be a place of peace that God meant for it to be. In the end, I believe that taking care of one another and loving each other to protect dignity is more important than having the correct doctrine or theology. When we hold each other's dignity, we truly become the body of Christ.